Hi. On the 5th and 6th of June 2024, I'll be speaking at the largest AI event in Asia, Super AI in Singapore, at the iconic Marina Bay Sands. Alongside brilliant minds like Edward Snowden, Benedict Devon, and Balaji Srinivasan, I'll be on a stage exploring the extraordinary potential of AI and the profound change it represents, not just for financial markets, but also for the world as we know it. With over 5,000 attendees and over 150 side events, Singapore will become a vibrant hub for a full week from the 3rd and 9th of June. Visit superai.com to register and join me with 20% off tickets using the code REALVISION. Use the link in the description and I'll see you there. It's going to be incredible.
Are the Fed's hands tied? Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. With me today is Peter Bukvar, CIO of Bleakley Financial Group. Hi, Peter. How are you?
Nice to see you again.
So we're kind of all waiting for the Fed, aren't we? Stocks cobbled together a modest rally. U.S. Treasury yields dipped a little bit. The dollar firmed a little bit. But it seems like everyone's really sitting on their hands until we hear from the FOMC on Wednesday. What, if anything, are you expecting to come out of the meeting?
I know everyone's going to obsess about the dot plot and are they going to reflect two hikes, three hikes? Who cares at this point, whether it's two or three? I'm most interested in the balance sheet and what they say. Powell said that this is the meeting they're going to start discussing it and the fate of it, especially because the reverse repo facility is just above $400 billion, down from north of two. And as that continues to shrink, if it shrinks, there'll be more focus on how much more room they have left to shrink the balance sheet. So that's, to me, what I want to hear. That is something that we probably won't get until the press conference, while the dot plot is going to come out right when the statement hits at 2 o'clock.
Yeah, you're right to point out that other really important part of it, but we'll have to wait. And you're right, there will be this sort of obsession with their forecasting. Do you think they have the latitude to signal lower rates or any kind of easing, given the type of economic data we've seen coming in? I mean, do the numbers justify a path to easing?
Well, the economic data has been mixed. I mean, the last payroll report, we saw a two-year high in the unemployment rate. On the other hand, since their last meeting at the end of January, the CRB index is up 5%. You have the inflation break-evens in the two-year TIPS up 50 basis points. And commodities, you know, specifically, you have energy prices now with WTI at 83 plus. You have gasoline prices at a multi-month high. You have food prices that are moving higher. So it's a tough situation for them. And throwing back on the economic stuff, retail sales are very mediocre in February after a soft January. So there's a lot of moving pieces for them, and it is, to me, somewhat stagflationary, even though the inflation number should continue to moderate in the coming months as rent growth slows. I still think it's a very difficult environment for them to figure out. Now, that said, I do think that Powell, if he's going to cut this year, wants to do it sooner rather than later. Mm-hmm. He doesn't want to wait until after the summer ahead of the election. But as I said, with the inflation stats remaining sticky and commodity prices rising, as well as inflation expectations, he's got a very difficult situation right now.
Yeah, they are kind of between a rock and a hard place on a couple of fronts. The timing is difficult because they'd probably rather wait, but we are in an election year. And traditionally, they like to try to stay away from right in the thick of the election so they're not seen as aiding or abetting one side or the other. They also have another problem that really came up in the first week of our special series that we're doing. And last week, we really focused on the challenges. And this is the growing inequity or inequality in across global economies. And the Fed is trying to serve two different groups, aren't they? They really understand, or you see the sort of bottom half, and I'll just be broadly and split it down the middle, but like the bottom half, who you can see are feeling the pain. Like, there are all these little anecdotal measurements. I know you've been looking at some of them where people, you can see that people are feeling strained. They've been dealing with these high prices for a while at the grocery store, even though one thing goes down and another one pops up and we all see it. And then off the flip side, the people who have you know, I have seen their assets growing. They're benefiting from the higher interest rates. They just seem to be in a good spot. But how does the Fed navigate dealing with both those constituencies?
Well, we know inflation hurts the bottom end the hardest, as what they spend on stuff that they need is a bigger percentage of their total income. So that's the tricky part here. And then what, you know, the answer that the Fed gives is let's raise interest rates, but that also hurts those people because a lot of them use credit cards and don't necessarily pay off their monthly balances and are paying 23% interest rate on the balance that they have. And then if they want to go buy a car, they got a high financing cost. So it is a difficult situation for the lower end. Now, over time, you hope that lower inflation actually ends up helping them because the lower income is also seeing some decent wage gains, particularly those in like leisure and hospitality, for example. But yeah, they've been hit the hardest from the cumulative impact. And we've heard that from a variety of different retailers over the course of the past month, whether it's the dollar stores, whether it's the Walmarts or the specialty stores or the other discounters or apparel. You know, a lot of them talked about sort of this tale of two consumers. But interestingly, Bank of America, they have their monthly snapshot of the U.S. consumer. And they even today talked about even higher income consumers that are pulling back on spend. Those that make up to 600 grand, where people making north of 600 are spending the same and they haven't changed their habits. But now that you have that gap between those that make 100 and 600, they're beginning to rein it in as well. So you wouldn't know that from looking at the stock market, of course, but you know, there are definitely some pockets of weakness. And I think we should really be focused on the labor market moderation that is being seen in a lot of different data points, because that could be sort of the next phase of this economic cycle that begins to bite from higher interest rates.
Yeah. Do you think that, do you expect the Fed to stay on course and just steady as she goes, not really change her messaging that much? Or do you think we'll see something different out of the meeting? And how are the markets positioned for that?
Well, it comes down to what does Powell fear the most? Does he fear a further rise in the unemployment rate that he wants to respond to? Or does he fear if he starts getting complacent that inflation starts to inflect higher again, and he just cut interest rates, and now inflation's back to 4.5% again? That's a really difficult position to be in. I think he should stick it out and not cut too many times. If he's going to cut, okay, one or two times, let's give him that to maybe take some of the edge off. But he's really not going to be able to do much more because what happens if he gets more aggressive than that? The dollar tanks and oil, instead of 83, up from 70, goes to 93 or 100. There aren't many easy choices for him right now. And, you know, I don't envy his position.
Yeah, it's a tough one. The other sort of headline grabbing focus is NVIDIA. They've been having their conference. This is such a tough one. I feel like so many people have it in their portfolios. They're just wringing their hands about and really afraid to get caught. It's sort of, you know, some kind of bubble bursting on this. And then there are tech enthusiasts who just look at their plans and say that they're on the front edge of what is a revolution. How are you thinking about this, the NVIDIA story here?
Leaving the fundamentals to more tech savvy and smarter people on this than me. I just think that investors that are going to be in it just need to have eyes wide open, eyes wide open on its valuation. It's trading at what, 20 times sales. And if they grow revenue at 20% a year for the next 5 years, and that growth rate assumes basically very little competition, even though their biggest customers today want to be their competitors tomorrow and developing their own chips. So let's just say you grow revenue 20% a year for the next 5 years. So you double revenue again. Even in by 2028, you're trading at 10 times sales for a semiconductor company in a very cyclical industry. Again, I don't want to downtalk NVIDIA because I have no no skin in the game other than we have clients that own it, whether it's individually or in funds. But again, like I said, I think investors should have eyes wide open on the valuation side, putting aside, you know, how great the technology is. And also the parabolic nature of its stock move. You know, when a stock goes vertical, for whatever reason, what it's doing, it's pulling forward future returns. And that's what people have to acknowledge here. Just like we saw, and not just in tech, we saw it in Abercrombie & Fitch and GE that went parabolic. We saw it in Vistra, which is an energy company that went parabolic. When a stock just gets into that pattern, and I'm no skilled technician, but I know a parabolic move when I see one, it just steals from future returns. And let's, you know, take Cisco, which I know a lot of people like to make the comparison, even though Cisco was more grossly overvalued in 2000 than NVIDIA is today. The point still stands that when a stock goes crazy to the upside, you pull forward so much future returns. In 2000, fiscal year 2000, Cisco made 57 cents a share. This year, they're expected to make, I think, about $3.70 a share. And in the 24 years, the stock has gone from 80 to 50.
Yeah.
That's because of that massive move in the late 90s into 2000, basically front-loaded 25 years and plus possibly of future stock market returns. And back then, Cisco was it. It was the backbone of the internet. So a lot of the sexy talk about NVIDIA today, I heard a lot about the sexy talk with Cisco. And yes, valuations aren't necessarily the same, but Cisco ain't cheap. I'm sorry, NVIDIA ain't cheap today.
Hey everyone, we're going to take a quick break right now to hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Good news and bad news. First, the bad news. Mint is shutting down. The good news? There's an even better alternative. Many Mint users are turning to Monarch Money and loving it. Monarch is the top-rated all-in-one personal finance app. It gives you a comprehensive view of all of your accounts, investments, transactions, cash flow, net worth, and more. Plus, create custom budgets, track progress toward financial goals, and collaborate with your partner. And now listeners of this show will get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/vision. Monarch has a tool that allows you to easily import your data from Mint and keep all of your tags and categories. It's the most customizable budgeting app. Change the layout of your dashboard, toggle between light and dark mode, create custom budgets and notifications, set up automatic rules for transactions and notifications, and more. Monarch is obsessed with constantly improving the product. They release updates every 2 weeks and allow customers to submit suggestions, vote on requested features, and view the product roadmap. After reading the reviews, I can see why it's the top-rated personal finance app. And right now, listeners of this show will get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/vision. That's monarchmoney.com/vision for your extended 30-day free trial. Go to monarchmoney.com/vision.
I like that way of looking at it because it doesn't discount what NVIDIA is doing. It's just saying, listen, it's just pulling it forward, which is something I've been thinking about as well. So it doesn't discount their plan. Or their fundamentals. It's just it's a great way to look at it, I think, and it's going to give some people some food for thought. We have a question about the BOJ coming in from Ralph, and I was thinking about this as well because I know you watch Japan, and we're talking about getting ready for the Fed. The Bank of Japan, the central bank there, had its meeting and finally abandoned its negative rate policy. This is the last holdout for that. Ralph asking, what do you think of US, yen US dollar weakening despite the BOJ getting off its less than zero rate policy?
So finally, yes, and good riddance to negative rate policy and yield curve control and the buying of ETFs, which was nonsensical if their goal was higher inflation. I think the yen move is more of just a sell in the news. It was definitely well telegraphed what the BOJ eventually did. I don't think that the yen weakness is going to be sustainable, but also we have to add into that, yes, now that Japan did this quote-unquote big move by raising their overnight rate all of 10 basis points and 20 if you give it the range that they laid out. But we can't expect them to move anytime soon. So there's not like there's this immediate threat of a further interest rate hike because the BOJ is going to take their darn time in doing anything more. But Ueda definitely did say that, hey, if inflation still remains well above our target, we can definitely raise interest rates again. Now, the problem with the BOJ is because of the debt of the Japanese government, being so large, the BOJ is essentially an arm of the Japanese government, and on one hand needs to keep financing costs low for the Japanese government. But on the other hand, if inflation is going to continue to print 3% plus core rate, can they still with a straight face even keep their overnight rate of plus 0.1%? I do think, though, it's the BOJ has been buying less JGBs. At the same time, the Bank of England has been selling gilts, and the ECB is shrinking their balance sheet, and the Fed will continue on with QT, even if they taper it at some point. And so the liquidity pump, I do think, slows as the year progresses, and another thing that investors need to keep their eye on. So to what I said to start this interview is that people are going to obsess tomorrow about the Fed's going to cut two or three times this year. They should start shifting their focus to global balance sheets, global central bank balance sheets, as I do think that is going to begin to matter soon.
Yeah, it's a great point. So when, you know, one of the things that we've been when talking about, and I'm laughing when you were saying about, you know, trying to figure out this tech move in my head, because we get so many questions about people who are trying to figure out these very difficult questions, right? Whether you're looking at why the yen, why currencies are moving, you know, when you anticipate something happening and it goes the opposite direction, there's a trader mentality to that. When you're trying to figure out balance sheets, that's so macroeconomic. And there's a lot of fear around all of it. We spoke with three performance coaches this week. We sort of kicked off this week. We're looking at solutions and opportunities and how to figure out what to do in this uncertain environment. And we talked to three performance coaches about the sort of mental game. And Denise Schull was one of them. And she had this very sage advice. Let's have a listen and we'll talk on the other side.
There are essentially infinite number of ways to make money in the market. Like, I mean, if you could catch every little price, you know, every little move of every little thing, think how much money is there. You just have to figure out, like, how you see it and what makes sense to you. What is your version of understanding what makes prices move? And then stick with it. And it can be, you know, some people are scalpers and some people are trading for weeks and months at a time. You know, I found myself to be a momentum trader, and this was back when I traded equities. Like, that's how it made sense to me. The drug stocks move together. Like, you have to figure out your version. You learned from somebody, and unless you're really sure that the person you learned from makes money and their viewpoint, their lens in the market makes sense, you've got to go back to, like, where am I in this system? How does it make sense to me? And what can I do about that? Which, believe it or not, your feelings are going to give you all sorts of information about that if you learn to think of them as data.
I mean, Denise just always nails it. You could see that whole session, fascinating conversation with all three of them, chock full of fantastic advice, both about trading, but about life as well. The full session is on our website. And Peter, you and I talked about finding your lane when we did the session on researching like a pro. And you very much had to sort of shift and pivot and figure out what you were good at. And I think that's such good advice to everyone.
Yeah, I definitely agreed with what Denise said. And her point that there's no one way to be successful investing or trading in the markets. You really need to just find your own way and get comfortable with what you're good at and get comfortable with what style best suits your personality.
Yeah. And so Peter obviously leaned into his research and ability to research and look deeply into stocks and fundamentals and find value where other people are not looking, which is what we always tap him for here. And of course, on the marketplace, his work is on the marketplace. If you head over to the tab, you can find out more and subscribe. And so, Peter, let's lean into your expertise a little bit, because we have a question. Who is this one from? It is on China. Dominic, any thoughts on China? That's very broad, but I do know you look globally. How are you thinking about what's happening in China right now? We saw signs of life from the economy to the extent that we can depend on any official figures coming out of that. But what are you looking at?
I think it's important to separate out China long-term, looking at the next 5 to 10 years, and China's issues that they have right now. I'm going to put aside the authoritarian government and Taiwan and what the government approach to business is right now. But just looking at from an economic standpoint, they're obviously dealing with the stress of residential real estate. But I do think that policy-wise, they're doing their best to work through it. They're allowing developers to go bust. They're very focused on getting projects done that are uncompleted, that people have put down deposits. I think that would be very important in sort of clearing the system by getting these projects done and allowing people to get a fully constructed apartment that they decided to buy. Manufacturing in China is dealing with the same challenges that manufacturing around the world is dealing with, and that's a manufacturing recession that we've been in for more than a year, as consumers have shifted their spend to more services than goods, and other parts of the global economy are soft. Then you have the consumer, which still has some PTSD from the COVID shutdowns, but showing signs of life. We saw that with the travel numbers during the Lunar New Year. We see that in the Macau visitation numbers that are almost back to where they were 2019, and gross gaming revenues that are above 2019 levels. Domestic travel in China is well above 2019 levels. So that's the short-term sort of breakdown. But then the Chinese consumer is dealing with a reduction in the value of real estate prices. So there's still going to be a lot of pushes and pulls here. But looking out over the next 10 years, the size of the Chinese middle class is going to double in the next 5 to 10 years, from about 400 million people to 800 million people. They're going to add an entire United States and then some in terms of a growing middle class. And just think what that means for purchasing power, not just within China, but around the world. 2019, the Chinese tourist spent $250 billion internationally, and that went to zero during the shutdowns and is still below where it was in 2018, but should continue to recover. And again, looking out over the next 10 years, and it's not just the Chinese middle class that is going to see a big increase. It's India, it's Indonesia, it's Vietnam, it's Thailand that are going to see this growing middle class that should be a lift to growth in that entire region, where it just so happens that half the world's population happens to live in.
Yeah. So based on what we saw with, we know that tariffs and trade are going to be, there's going to be a lot of rhetoric. That doesn't mean it's policy, but there's going to be a lot of rhetoric around this U.S. election. If you're going to play those growing middle classes, do you do it regionally in Asia, as opposed to sort of maybe what you might have done it in a safer way with a, you know, mega cap Western-based consumer business? You know, China favors their homegrown. Do you have to look at Chinese companies, or do you have to look at plays within the Asian Pacific region in order to benefit from that?
We're going to take another quick break to hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
You've heard the headlines. Inflation is unchecked. The dollar is collapsing. The government is printing too much money. The fear is real, but there is a solution: gold. The government can't print more gold, gold isn't collapsing, and gold's value increases during inflationary times. Noble Gold Investments is here to help you protect your wealth. Noble Gold Investments is the gold IRA company that Americans trust. The founders of Noble Gold have more than 20 years of combined experience in buying gold and silver. They've secured more than $1 billion in precious metals for their clients. Whether you're a seasoned investor or new to the game, Noble Gold Investments simplifies and secures your gold investment journey. Choose between a tax-advantaged gold IRA or have physical gold delivered to your door. Noble Gold Investments ensures a seamless and easy transaction. Invest in something you can hold. Go to noblegoldinvestments.com/vision to get started. Don't wait. That's noblegoldinvestments.com/vision. Few investments make a better long-term hedge against inflation, depression, and economic downturns than precious metals like gold and silver. Plan for the inevitable and protect your environment savings with a gold-backed IRA from Noble Gold Investments. Noble Gold Investments is the gold IRA company that Americans trust. The founders of Noble Gold have more than 20 years of combined experience in buying gold and silver. They have secured more than $1 billion in precious metals for their clients. Gold remains steady when inflation is on the rise and the dollar is in turmoil. Its value doesn't just hold, it increases during inflationary periods. And unlike money, gold can't be printed. It's your shield in times of economic uncertainty. Invest in something you can hold. Go to noblegoldinvestments.com/vision to get started. Don't wait. That's noblegoldinvestments.com/vision.
Well, it's a great question, because if we get into another global tariff war, nobody wins, but it's possible that the U.S. actually loses more. Because I mentioned, you know, half the world's population is over in Asia. And as time goes on, China is going to rely less on the U.S. consumer to buy their stuff because they have this growing middle class all around them. So it is possible that a trade war actually hurts us more. And look at the EU is trying to figure out how to keep all these China-made EVs out of their economic region, and the U.S. doing the same. I mean, it's going to be a lot of losers under a global protectionist trade war situation. Now, in terms of how to play the Chinese consumer, yeah, I think it's better to do it locally. It's owning casinos in Macau and other areas of Asia. It's owning things that can tap into the Chinese consumer that would spend irregardless of what a tariff battle would do for manufactured goods.
Yeah, that's a great point, and a reason why we keep touching on it. We did it last week, geopolitics, because it's kind of hard to avoid that. What are your thoughts about? We talked about NVIDIA before, but what are your thoughts about the reshoring theme? I think you were looking at this right when it comes to semiconductors, because you know we know that they've been a hot area of the market. There was a lot of conversation around that. What's the reality versus what's actually happening on the ground, and is that an issue for semis?
Well, on the chip side, yeah, reshoring is easier said than done. There was an article in the Nikkei News basically saying that at least in the plans to build not just semiconductor fabs in Arizona, but you need a lot of suppliers to that are also building out facilities in Arizona, that it's costing up to five times more than it would cost to do in Asia. Mm-hmm. And at least double the initial cost that they penciled out when they first thought about doing this. So it's, this is sort of industrial policy gone awry, because, okay, I understand that we don't want chips made maybe in Taiwan because of the threats from China, but what's wrong with a chip factory in Japan or in South Korea where we can buy chips? Yeah, ideally, yeah, it'd be nice to build chip factories in the U.S., no question, have it right here. But the cost of doing it is punitive in a sense. And it means that not just finishing these facilities, but the cost of the products we're going to buy is going to go up a lot more. So just industrial policy gone awry, and we're now seeing it. And also look at all the government incentives to build EV battery factories. Just as the demand for EVs are going south, because more people want to buy hybrids. I can only imagine how many mothballed factories there are going to be in Kansas after all said and done.
This is the hard thing about central planning, right? I mean, the Chinese know this well. You know, that's why they have a lot of vacancies, and a lot of when you're top down and it's slow moving, you have bureaucracy, and then you have now what we know are rolling, you know, material costs that, you know, it's, as I mentioned with food, it just seemed to be whack-a-mole. I'm assuming the higher cost is not just wages, but also materials. And is that an issue for housing as well? Are we seeing that as an overhang for housing?
So if you looked at the NAHB, the builder survey report that we saw on Monday, they definitely talked about the supply constraints from the high cost of land, labor, and materials. So that is still a factor in delivering. Now, the bigger builders certainly have more efficient economies of scale. They can absorb that much better. But the smaller builders that are competing for construction labor, I mean, take a construction job. Well, if you're a construction worker, well, you can build a house, or you can build a semi-fab, or you can build an EV manufacturing building. You know, if you can, you know, have certain skills that are transferable. So it's the high cost. Everyone's now competing for these construction jobs and this construction labor. So that's another thing that the government, they don't think about is, okay, yeah, great. Let's have these plans to build all these facilities. But they didn't think about where we're going to find the bodies to actually do it.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. That in itself is a circles back to the demographic issues we've been talking about and policy. Gridlock, which doesn't solve any of that. Question coming in from Peter, sorry, for Doug. Peter, if you had just one thing to look at that might trip up the markets, what would it be? Is there an area that you're worried about?
I think we have to watch a couple of things. These parabolic moves we're seeing and how how it goes from here. Usually parabolic moves don't correct by going sideways. They correct by going back down again. And these have been sort of leading the market. So I want to see that. I want to see how also, you know, you look at the Magnificent Seven that is completely splintered, where Tesla's dropping out, Apple potentially dropping out. We'll see about Google. It's trying to obviously compete against AI, but it's now threatened by AI and Perplexity and others. And so if the foundation of the market in terms of leadership were more on semiconductor companies, that's a more volatile, fragile foundation than if it was built on, you know, the secular growers that we saw the past 15, 20 years in Microsoft, Google, Apple, and Amazon, for example. The other thing is, as I mentioned earlier, what the Fed says about the balance sheet and whether rates continue to rise. I mean, quietly, interest rates keep rising. And you wouldn't know from the stock market, but you know, the 2-year, the 10-year yields have gone straight up over the past month. And we have to keep our eye on that as well, because having interest rates high for a while is very pernicious on an economy that was built on zero rate for a long time. And we're seeing rising delinquencies. We saw that in the Capital One reported, I think it was on Monday, their monthly charge-off and delinquency data. And their net charge-off rate rose to the highest level since 2011.
Oof.
So there are a lot of things that we really need to keep our eyes on here. And, you know, I've been saying a lot on this channel for the past year plus is that I've been more worried about the death by a thousand cuts effect from higher interest rates rather than, you know, this big event or a massive recession or this collapse of some sort that scaremongers throwing out. I was more of just nick here and there from a higher cost of capital. And I still am sticking to that and thinking that it's quietly playing out.
Yeah. And you know, just the nature of the cycle and the focus. I mean, you're reading all about NVIDIA. Nobody is sort of paying attention to that detail to the level that you are, Peter. And it's so appreciated because that is the kind of stuff that's your early warning signal that things are getting tough. The extend and pretend can't last forever. And the longer rates stay high, the harder that becomes. So, you know, we know in commercial real estate as well. So definitely something for us to keep our eye on. Peter, we always love catching up with you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Maggie. Always a pleasure.
Okay, programming note for all of you. The series continues this week, and we are looking at, as I said, solutions, opportunities, what you can do about it. We have Raoul talking blockchain this afternoon. Tomorrow, Beth Kindig and Jordy Visser are going to be talking about tech investing, not just like momentum crazy follow. They're going to be nuanced about it. It's going to be a super interesting conversation. Tune in for that. And Thursday, we're looking at the opportunities around longevity, some really wild stuff happening on that. And then Friday, very important, we are holding our day of workshops. It's first come, first serve. You need to be plus or above. Jump on the 14-day offer for just $1 to be able to reserve your spot and or watch it on the platform. It's going to be great. We'll have a whole list of people. Raoul's going to be doing one. The Najarian brothers are going to be doing one on options. There's going to be a lot of great stuff. So be sure you join us for all of that. And we'll see you then. We'll be back with more tomorrow. So stay with us. Thanks, everybody. Take care and good luck out there.
One of the most popular Real Vision series ever is back. How to Unfuck Your Future will explore the problems we're currently facing and, more importantly, present solutions. We've got an incredible roster of guests, including Raoul Pell, Dario Perkins, Beth Kindig, and Denise Scholl. We'll be digging into the crucial topics, including how AI is going to impact election year politics, the problems with central banks, the global housing crisis, and a lot more. You'll get in-depth, long-form analysis from real experts on the stuff that's really happening. And best of all, you'll get access to the entire series for just $1, which is kind of insane. Go to realvision.com/your future. That's realvision.com/your future and join us for what's going to be an epic 2 weeks of learning and discovery.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. At Real Vision, we arm you with the expert knowledge, time-efficient tools, and a powerful network to help you succeed on your financial journey. Get a taste of financial freedom with our free offer at realvision.com/free.